Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the 20th anniversary on Saturday of the 9/11 attacks on the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and the attempt to destroy the Capitol, and speak with a 9/11 widow and activist, Kristen Breitweiser, who is known for pressuring Washington to provide a public accounting of what went wrong on the morning of September the 11th and in the month leading up to it. She testified before the Joint Inquiry of Congress in September 2002 and the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee in August of 2004 with regard to national security reforms, and is the author of Wake Up Call, The Political Education of a 9/11 Widow. Kristen joins us to discuss her article at The Intercept, My Husband Died on 9/11, I Am Still Waiting for a Trial of His Killers, and question why nobody has been brought to trial for the murders of 3,000 and the lack of clarity on the role of the Saudis in the planning and execution of the attack. And then we'll speak with Stephen Wertheim, a senior fellow in the American Statecraft Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the author of Tomorrow the World, The Birth of U.S. Global Supremacy in World War II. He joins us to discuss his article in Foreign Affairs, Biden the Realist, The President's Foreign Policy Doctrine Has Been Hiding in Plain Sight, and how during his presidential campaign, Biden insisted that U.S. service members should be sent into combat only to defend the United States, stating, quote, "The responsibility I have is to protect America's national self-interest and not put our women and men in harm's way to try to solve every single problem in the world by use of force." Then finally, we will speak with David Blight, the Sterling Professor of American History and the director of the Gilda Lehrman Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition at Yale University. He's the author of Race and Reunion, The Civil War in American Memory, and Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. And his research was used in an amicus brief supporting Virginia Governor Ralph Northam's order to remove the statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee from Richmond's Monument Avenue on Wednesday. And we will discuss how much today's Republican Party is the party of the Confederacy. And before we go to our first guest, now that I have resigned in protest from Pacifica and its Los Angeles station KPFK, we have moved fully to online broadcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where we will be depending upon you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program alive during the critical years ahead in which the fate of American democracy will be decided. For those of you who can, help us keep delivering a daily briefing so that those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate can also join in the fight against disinformation, whether it comes from Mar-a-Lago or Moscow. We must win the political warfare battles underway and fight with weaponized facts to save our democracy as we create a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Kristen Breitweiser, who's a 9/11 widow and activist who is known for pressuring Washington to provide a public accounting of what went wrong on the morning of September the 11th and the month leading up to it. She testified before the Joint Inquiry of Congress in September 2002 and the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee in August of 2004 with regard to national security reforms. And she's the author of Wake Up Call, The Political Education of a 9/11 Widow, and has an article at The Intercept, My Husband Died on 9/11. I Am Still Waiting for a Trial of His Killers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kristen Breitweiser.
Thanks for having me back on.
Well, thanks for joining us, Kristen. And as you point out in your article, the World Trade bombers in 1993 and those behind the 1998 bombings of the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania and the USS Cole as well in 2000 were brought to justice, but the 9/11 attack in which 3,000 people died, there has yet to be anybody of any significance brought to trial, and it's extraordinary to think about it in that context. I'm sure you've thought about it a lot, Kristen. Why do you think it is that we have never had any justice for the 3,000 who died, including your husband?
You know, well, first and foremost, it's prosecutorial choice to have not held anyone accountable, any of the co-conspirators accountable, and to bring them to justice. And I think there's three reasons for that: political expediency, matters of cover-up, and embarrassment. And I just, you know, as an American citizen, we live in the United States of America, which is supposed to be a democracy based upon the rule of law. And I just find it absolutely reprehensible that 20 years out, there were 3,000 homicides in broad daylight in Lower Manhattan, and not one president, not one attorney general, not one U.S. attorney or a Manhattan district attorney has thought fit to, you know, carry out an indictment and a full prosecution of any co-conspirator of those 3,000 homicides. And this isn't a faculty of them not having the evidence and information to do so. The truth of the matter is our government has plenty of information in its files regarding the logistical support, the financial support, the training camps, the movements of these hijackers in and out of the country, who helped them get in and out of the country, who paved the way for them, you know, with their visas. And for whatever reason, our government has literally chosen to not do that. And I want to point out that that is not a Democrat or Republican decision. It is on both sides of the aisle. You know, we've had 2 decades worth of presidents and Congresses who have chosen to not hold any co-conspirators accountable. And I think that that sends a tremendously dangerous message to the world and to terrorists, that you can come inside this country, wantonly murder 3,000 innocent civilians and not be held to account.
Well, the extraordinary thing is that the mastermind of the 9/11 attacks, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is at Guantanamo, he was waterboarded, I think, 187 times, I believe. He has admitted to everything. And yet, you know, there he is in Guantanamo, which seems to be a device in order to avoid having a U.S. trial. But the attempts to get a trial going in New York were scuttled because New York objected to it. So is this Guantanamo a kind of a convenience? Because my sense is that maybe the U.S. government really doesn't want a full accounting, and they certainly don't want Khalid Sheikh Mohammed going public and using it as a platform to espouse his ideology. What do you think is the problem, why the very man who planned this whole thing, who's admitted to it, can't be put on trial?
You know, I think one of the problems is probably that perhaps what Mohammed would say would not quite match up with the narrative that's been put forth. You know, there are incredible gaping holes in the story or the narrative surrounding the 9/11 attacks. And the reality is the 9/11 Commission, which was supposedly the official account of what happened, based all of its understanding of the who, what, where, when, and how of the 9/11 attacks on the quote-unquote interrogations of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And anyone who's read Dianne Feinstein's Senate Intel report on torture knows that any information gleaned during torture is incredibly not reliable. It's absolutely non-credible information. And so when you pull away from that, what you realize is that you have a 9/11 Commission's final report based on absolute bunk. And I don't think that that's a comforting feeling. I know it's not comfortable for me as a 9/11 family member. And at the end of the day, we're never going to be able to hold Khalid Sheikh Mohammed accountable, even though he made a self-admission. We're never going to be able to hold Ramzi bin al-Sheed, Khalid bin Attash, or even Abu Zubaydah accountable for their roles in 9/11. And that's solely because of the CIA's torture of those detainees. And again, it's another instance of the U.S. government or, you know, agencies within the U.S. government impeding the path to justice, obstructing the path to justice that the 9/11 families should be entitled to under the Constitution and laws of this country.
And again, I'm speaking with Kristen Breitwiser, 9/11 widow and activist, who is known for pressuring Washington to provide a public accounting of what went wrong on the morning of September 11th and the month leading up to it. She testified before the Joint Inquiry of Congress in September 2002 and the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee in August of 2004 with regard to national security reforms, and is the author of Wake Up Call, The Political Education of a 9/11 Widow. And she has an article at The Intercept, My Husband Died on 9/11. I am still waiting for a trial of his killers. And of course, you could go back further than the planning of 9/11 through with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, because as we started out talking about the coal bombing, the embassy bombings, and the 1993 World Trade bombing, Al-Qaeda was active. There were many opportunities missed to assassinate bin Laden, and Frank Pellegrino, the FBI agent who was on the trail of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed for years, he was about to arrest him in Qatar, and the U.S. embassy there stopped him from doing it. So we need an accounting also of how the U.S. government allowed Al-Qaeda to get away with it for so long, don't you think?
You're 100% correct, and that's what I was hinting towards when I said who sort of greased the wheels of these guys getting their visas and moving with such incredible ease in and out of this country in the lead up to the 9/11 attacks. The reality is two of the well-known hijackers that a lot of people recognize the names of, Al-Midar and Hazmi, you know, they were able to get in and out of this country far too easily. They were known Al-Qaeda operatives. They were clearly on several intelligence agencies' radar. And someone needs to answer as to why and how they were so easily able to get in and out of this country repeatedly in the years before 9/11. And I always not only look to the situation in Qatar with KSM, but I also look towards what happened with regard to the blind sheikh in the lead up to the 93 bombing, where you had the blind sheikh applying for a U.S. visa, I think 11 times, being denied because of his role or his alleged role in the assassination of the Egyptian president. And on the 12th time, he was given agency clearance to come inside the country, and he came inside the country and thereafter carried out, or helped carry out the World Trade Center 93 attack. So I don't quite know why no one was held accountable for that. I don't know why it's okay for certain intelligence agencies to allow people to get into this country that thereafter murder Americans. But, you know, we're setting a really dangerous precedent when we allow these intelligence agencies to make these sort of, if you want to be friendly or kind and say, judgment decisions, and then not hold them accountable when innocent people are killed. And the same goes for foreign policy decisions by our State Department. You know, we've got how many decades worth of foreign policy decisions that are just dead wrong, and they cost innocent lives. And the people that make these decisions, they're never held to account. And I think that as a public, the American people need to start getting better educated and getting better engaged on these issues so that, you know, we can change that cost-benefit analysis that's being carried out by our leaders so that they make better decisions and we don't have situations like we see unfolding in Afghanistan this very day.
So, Kristen Breitweiser, you've been calling for the release of the 9/11 files to be made public, and President Biden is releasing some files. But in your article at The Intercept, you point out the inconsistency here with the alacrity with which the CIA released its files on Khashoggi, and how Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and his Tiger Squad murdered and dismembered Khashoggi in the consulate in Istanbul. And this, of course, was hugely embarrassing. But for some reason or other, and I think it had a lot to do with the CIA's relationship with Mohammed bin Nayef, who should have been the Crown Prince, but then the Trump administration backed MBS, and the rest is history. But the fact that the CIA went out of their way to release the real information, which was that MBS was completely orchestrated the murder and dismemberment of Khashoggi. So why would they be so eager to release that information and not information regarding the lead up to 9/11 and the many missed opportunities?
Well, I think you're spot on with your summary there of what happened with Khashoggi and his interplay with MBN, MBS, and the CIA. And I think that with anything in life, if you can find a common interest with other people, then you can all come to a shared goal. And I think when it comes to releasing information with regard to September 11th, for very clear reasons, certain entities in the U.S. government and its intelligence apparatus are very reticent to share information. And there's a reason for that. And unfortunately, you know, my fellow widows and 9/11 family members have thus far not been very successful in forcing the hand of intelligence agencies to release this information. I'm heartened and hopeful that President Biden will be the first president that will be willing to release this information, because it's been 20 years. And I think that we are entitled to get the information so that we can hold everyone accountable. But it is not lost on me, the saying, I think, that Chuck Schumer said, that, you know, you don't want to mess with the intelligence agencies because they'll get you 8 ways to Tuesday. And I think that that's one of the largest reasons why, you know, we're having so much trouble getting access to this information. The intelligence agencies have a strong hand and a strong control over parts of our government, and they're making sure that this information is not let out to the American public. And, you know, I'm sorry, I think we live in America, and we don't live in Russia, and we don't live in Cambodia or Chile, and we are entitled to have this information as an American public, and I think we should be told the truth.
Well, obviously there's something being hidden here, and I don't understand how important it could possibly be, and what this opaque relationship between the CIA and Saudi Arabia is, and what they are protecting, because it's now come up in this trial where Mohammed bin Salman, through this Saudi sovereign wealth fund, is suing Saad al-Jabri, who's a former counterintelligence chief who worked under Mohammed bin Nayef, who is now, of course, under house arrest by MBS, who's confiscated his fortune. And he should have been, as I mentioned, the crown prince. He was in line, and he was the CIA's favorite. And Trump comes along and promotes his, what, half-brother, second cousin, or whatever he is, MBS. And there was probably some money changed hands between the Trumps and the Kushners and the Saudis. I would suspect that that would almost be a certainty.
Perhaps the Emiratis as well.
Yeah, exactly. So, but now you have the situation where the Director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines, has closed down this court case, where the Saudis are suing al-Jabri, who's holed up in Canada, and they've threatened, he's been many attempts on his life. In fact, the same Tiger Squad was sent to Canada to kill him by MBS. But the long and the short of it is, why did the CIA kill this trial? Because they didn't want classified information revealed in the trial. So what's the nature of this classified information, do you think, and does it relate to 9/11?
Well, I think if you're referring to the Saqqab case up in, I think, Boston or somewhere, there's two cases that involve Jabri. I think the one in Boston, which involves the embezzlement accusations against him, that was brought by MBS. And then there's the case in D.C. where Jabri is, you know, trying to get protection from the attempted assassination on behalf of, you know, the Tiger Squad, like what happened with Khashoggi. Interestingly, we had a State Department submit a statement to the court in D.C. on behalf of Jabri, saying that he's a wonderful person and he's an ally of the United States and, you know, a very valuable intelligence, you know, partner, I guess you would say. And yet in Boston, the same intelligence apparatus, in this case the ODNI, Avril Haines, as you said, has intervened and said, oh, no, no, we can't release any information that might be released during this embezzlement, you know, allegation, because it's top secret national security information. Again, you have a situation connecting the U.S., the Saudis, probably a lot of money, and for whatever reason, our government considers that national security. As a citizen, I think we're entitled to see the information, and we're entitled to know the sort of relationship that is going back and forth between the Saudis and the U.S. And, you know, because it's costing lives, and our footprint in the Middle East is costing lives. And I think going forward, in order for Americans to be good citizens and to partake in democracy, you have to be educated. You have to have transparency. And I'm hopeful that President Biden will release some information. He's, you know, asked for a review of the 9/11 documents, and I'm, you know, cautiously optimistic that we might get some information.
So just in closing, Kristen, what will you be doing on Saturday, the 20th anniversary of 9/11?
I will probably be spending some quiet time outside, which is what I do every year. I feel closest to my husband when I'm out in nature. I certainly will not be visiting Ground Zero. I don't feel peace when I'm there. And I'll just be, you know, trying to wrap my arms around the day and recognizing that 20 years out, we're still fighting. We're still fighting to get truth, transparency, accountability, and justice. And in many ways, the biggest stumbling block in our way of achieving those things is my own government. And I just think that at some point, the government needs to start working with the 9/11 families so that we can have some sort of closure and peace with regard to the mass murder of our loved ones 20 years ago in broad daylight.
Well, Kristen Bradweiser, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Listen, thank you. Be well and stay safe.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Kristen Bradweiser, 9/11 widow and activist, who is known for pressuring Washington to provide a public accounting of what went wrong on the morning of September the 11th and the month leading up to it. She testified before the Joint Inquiry of Congress in September of 2002 and the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee in August of 2004 with regard to national security reforms, and is the author of Wake Up Call, The Political Education of a 9/11 Widow. And she has an article at The Intercept, My Husband Died on 9/11. I am still waiting for a trial of his killers. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Biden as a realist and a pragmatist in terms of his foreign policy.
Did you see the frightened ones? Did you hear the falling bombs? The flames are all long gone, but the pain lingers on. Goodbye, blue sky. Goodbye, blue sky. Goodbye.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Stephen Wertheim, who's a senior fellow in the American Statecraft Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the author of Tomorrow the World, The Birth of U.S. Global Supremacy in World War II. And he has an article in Foreign Affairs, Biden the Realist, The President's Foreign Policy Doctrine Has Been Hiding in Plain Sight. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Wertheim.
It's a pleasure to join you.
So in terms of Biden's foreign policy hiding in plain sight, there was an expectation, of course, that America would swing back to its sort of more traditional foreign policy after the chaos and amateurism of the Trump 4 years of the Trump wrecking crew, if you will. So in terms of his foreign policy doctrine hiding in plain sight, which we obviously want to talk to you further about, but just vis-a-vis the Europeans and NATO, what do you make of these tensions? Are they real? I keep reading about them, and I'm not quite sure. Some people defend what Biden's doing, and others suggest that he somehow irritated the Europeans, particularly with the withdrawal from Afghanistan. And I'm wondering whether that ties into the fact that he's more pragmatic than even the Europeans thought he would be.
Well, I think it's real that in some European capitals, there is upset about Biden's decision to withdraw and the consequences that have come with that withdrawal. That said, I am skeptical that fallout over the end of the war in Afghanistan will be a major factor impacting transatlantic relations going forward. I don't really see signs that this issue will spur Europe to take, in and of itself, will spur Europe to take a substantially more autonomous path in its own security affairs. And it's worth noting that although there were some quite elaborate calls, denunciations of Biden coming from the British Parliament in particular, over 20 years, America's NATO allies had the opportunity to be more active in the war in Afghanistan. They could have replaced the U.S. force if they felt that strongly about it. And they didn't really have the will to do that. So I expect these tensions to be papered over.
And of course, the criticisms coming from the Republicans are pretty hollow, given that these are the same people, in effect, who were practicing what Einstein considered to be a definition of insanity, which is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different outcome. And that's 20 years of doing that in Afghanistan.
Indeed. It was really troubling to hear so many prominent politicians and even commentators who aren't necessarily Republican aligned suggest that the war in Afghanistan was sustainable, was of low cost. Sustainable for whom? For the United States, that was pouring in trillions of dollars into this war? Was it sustainable for the service members who made the ultimate sacrifice? Was it sustainable for the thousands and thousands of Afghan civilians and soldiers who were losing their lives in this war? And by the way, the casualty rate among Afghans had been increasing of late. The numbers were not going down. So this was an unsustainable war. And I think now the challenge for the United States, for Americans as a whole, is to try to come to terms with what is quite a grievous loss in the war.
And of course, the fact that the Afghans were suffering such huge casualties is a lot to do with the dreadful deal that Trump made. I mean, he, for all that talk about the art of the deal, the guy was a complete idiot as far as making deals. He got rolled by Erdogan, he got rolled by Putin on every occasion, and Xi Jinping rolled him, and even I think Kim Jong-un did to some extent. So the idea that he made a deal with the Taliban that you guys can go ahead and beat the hell out of an Afghan army, but just you can't shoot at Americans. And it was hardly a surprise that the Taliban took over. But one of the things you point out in your article at Foreign Affairs, Stephen Wertheim, which I think is worth noting here, and that is that in 1991, Biden opposed the Gulf War, which was very popular at the time. That certainly is surprising. And then, of course, later, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, he became much more hawkish on enlarging NATO. But that vote back in 1991 was a pretty unpopular vote, wasn't it? I seem to recall there was a great deal of jingoism associated with the Gulf War. It was the first big television war. It sort of put CNN on the map.
That's right. And at the time, Joe Biden asked, to quote him, "What vital interests of the United States justify sending Americans to their deaths in the sands of Saudi Arabia?" End quote. It rings a bell with what he's been saying about Afghanistan in his series of defenses of his decision to withdraw, when he's been stark that the only purpose for U.S. combat in Afghanistan was to go after the terrorists who attacked the United States on 9/11. He rejected outright the very objective that the United States should try to build a new Western-style democratic state in Afghanistan. And so that's why my co-author and I wrote this with Josh Schifrinson, a professor at Boston University. We wanted to understand where this was coming from in Biden's makeup, and that vote against the Gulf War in 1991 is notable. But it's also worth saying that perhaps due to the popularity of that war in the United States, Biden shifted quickly thereafter. He actually recanted his opposition to the Gulf War and distinguished himself as an advocate of the expansion of NATO as well as U.S. military intervention, particularly in support of Bosnians in the war coming out of the collapse of Yugoslavia.
And again, I'm speaking with Stephen Wertheim, who's a senior fellow in the American Statecraft Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the author of Tomorrow the World, The Birth of U.S. Global Supremacy in World War II. And he has an article at Foreign Affairs, Biden, the Realist, the President's Foreign Policy Doctrine Has Been Hiding in Plain Sight. So give us a quick sketch of what you mean, Stephen, about Biden's foreign policy doctrine hiding in plain sight.
Well, I would say that Biden has shown an orientation toward pragmatism and toward realism that might be a bit surprising given the way he was perceived on the campaign and even given some of the things he said on the campaign and as president. He seemed to be promising, at least in the eyes of many, on the campaign trail to stand for a restoration of the status quo anti-Trump in U.S. foreign policy, a return to the kind of pursuit of liberal hegemony across the world that the United States has defined itself through since the collapse of the Soviet Union. And he's surrounded himself with well-seasoned advisors. And yet, you know, listening to Biden decide to withdraw from Afghanistan and defend that decision, it's striking that there's something else going on, that actually Biden, for at least the past 15 years, has become a skeptic of what he described recently as major military operations to remake other countries, first in Iraq and then in Afghanistan. And he's been hiding in plain sight, in a sense, because a lot of this information has been known for a while, and yet an anti-war reputation hasn't been attached to Joe Biden. So Joe Biden in 2006, when the so-called surge of U.S. forces in Iraq was first put forward, blasted that idea, and he opposed the surge there. And then as vice president under Barack Obama, he was the foremost opponent of the surge of U.S. troops to pursue a counterinsurgency strategy in Afghanistan. He advocated only a narrow counterterrorism mission, and at least in the, according to the memoirs of Richard Holbrooke, a U.S. envoy at the time to Afghanistan and Pakistan, he wanted to leave the war in Afghanistan altogether.
Well, in fact, Holbrooke actually had a much more holistic approach. He wanted to deal with Kashmir first. In other words, if you deal with Kashmir, which is not easy by any stretch of the imagination, you deal with the tension between Pakistan and Afghanistan, which is at the heart of Pakistan's strategy to stab the United States in the back because they believe that India is meddling in their backyard on their other flank. And of course, that went nowhere. And as you point out, Biden was even yelling in these meetings, "I'm not sending my boy back there to risk his life on behalf of women's rights." Well, that's not going to go down very well with a lot of people out there, wouldn't you say?
Well, it depends who you ask. You know, if you take Afghanistan, it has been absolutely tragic to see people trying to flee the country as the Taliban has took over, and to think about what might happen to a whole generation of Afghan girls who were in cities like Kabul, who were able to get an education and now have their future in jeopardy. At the same time, the war was killing many Afghan women and girls and men in the countryside, in a country that is overwhelmingly non-urban. And so I think part of Biden's view, although it's interesting that he didn't emphasize the humanitarian aspect when he has given his speeches defending his decision to withdraw, I think, you know, part of what defenders of his decision to withdraw would say would be that although the war had some positive effects for some urban Afghan women and girls, it had profoundly negative effects for others in the countryside, and that helps to explain, I think, why Afghans in the countryside ultimately were receptive to the Taliban coming back into power after two decades.
Sure, and you see the clash now between the urban and the rural as these rural Taliban hicks, if you will, confronted by women in Kabul and an educated younger generation who just simply don't want to go back to the 7th century. So it's not entirely clear that the Taliban are going to have a comfortable time, although they could, of course, resort to incredible repression, which they're perfectly capable of. But just in the last few minutes, Stephen, is there an element here where when Biden said he doesn't want to send our boys to risk their lives, his own son, of course, Beau, served in Iraq. Do you think he got a lot of his input from his son and others who reflect the attitude of the actual men and women on the front lines? They usually have a very different perspective on these wars than the Pentagon has. The Pentagon, of course, is so tied in with contractors and this massive defense budget, which is reaching record levels, $778 billion for fiscal 2022. They're perfectly happy to leave billions of dollars worth of equipment behind in Afghanistan because that gets replaced and that's more money for them. So, you know, an old friend of mine, Colonel David Hackworth, who was the most decorated U.S. soldier, both in Korea and Vietnam, used to talk about how the military-industrial complex is always, it's all about the toys and not about the boys. Do you think that Biden was getting more influence from the boys as opposed to the toys?
Such an important point you've made. I do think that Biden certainly invokes his son, Beau, frequently. I think that's probably sincere. And I think Biden has been a politician consistently attentive to public opinion, not just the opinion of rank and file service members and veterans who strongly supported ending America's involvement in the war in Afghanistan, but also the public as a whole. And the public, it's remarkable to me in a recent Washington Post ABC News survey, 77% of the American public supported the withdrawal, even as most were displeased with the execution of the withdrawal. So I think Biden, this is part of Biden's consistent pragmatism. He tries to respond to where the country is and stay within the mainstream. And I think that in this case has led him to decisively end the war in Afghanistan. It also raises a question, though, about the wider war on terror, because that war on terror remains intact and there is less public pressure to cease aerial strikes via drones or commando raids, which the United States is now quite routinely conducting across a significant arc of the earth.
Well, that's the debate that we should be having, isn't it, Stephen? The guns and butter debate. I mean, it's never made any sense to fill potholes in Kabul and not in Main Street, USA. And if all we're doing is having special forces in all around the world and using drones, it's hard to justify this massive military budget. I mean, during the Cold War, we spent much less, and the Soviet Union could have destroyed us in 30 minutes.
That's right. And I think going forward, it will be interesting to see the extent to which the Biden administration makes material changes to the U.S. force posture in the world that deliver on its stated desire to focus on competition with China, with Russia being a secondary competitor, and to pivot away from the greater Middle East. In a sense, it's been more than a decade since U.S. leaders expressed that a pivot to Asia was appropriate. And yet when you pivot to something, that means you're pivoting from something else, and the pivot away from the greater Middle East hasn't happened. Biden's decision to end the war in Afghanistan suggests he may be more serious than his predecessors about effectuating such a pivot. He's ordered a global posture review to be completed by the Department of Defense. That's ongoing. So The events around Afghanistan, I think, make it more interesting what Biden will decide to do going forward.
Well, Stephen Wertheimer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Wertheimer, who's a senior fellow in the American Statecraft Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the author of Tomorrow the World, The Birth of U.S. Global Supremacy in World War II. And he has an article in Foreign Affairs, Biden the Realist, The President's Foreign Policy Doctrine Has Been Hiding in Plain Sight. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into today's Republican Party as the party of the Confederacy.
From whence shall we expect the approach of danger? Shall some transatlantic giant step the earth and crush us at a blow? Never. All the armies of Europe and Asia could not by force take a drink from the Ohio River or set a track on the Blue Ridge in the trial of a thousand years. If destruction be our lot, we ourselves must be its author and finisher. As a nation of free men, we will live forever or die by suicide.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now are David Blight, the Sterling Professor of American History and Director of the Gilda Lehrman Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition at Yale University. He's the author of numerous books, articles, and essays on post-Civil War American history, including Race and Reunion, The Civil War in American Memory, and Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom, for which he received the Pulitzer Prize for History, Abraham Lincoln Prize, Bancroft Prize, and Parkman Prize of the Society of American Historians, among other recognitions. And his research was used in an amicus brief supporting Virginia Governor Ralph Northam's order to remove the statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee from Richmond's Monument Avenue this week. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Blight.
Thank you, Ian. It's an honor to be with you.
Well, thank you, David. And the amicus brief, of course, paved the way for the removal, well, at least it paved the way for the Virginia Supreme Court to allow the removal of this enormous statue of Robert E. Lee, the last one on Monument Row in Richmond, Virginia, mm-hmm. which, of course, was the former capital of the Confederacy. So your brief played a part. So give us a brief summary of what your argument was.
Well, it did play a part. The law firm that the governor's office hired to do this did what I think is a fairly unusual thing. They came to a group of historians who all of us have written books on the Civil War, the aftermath, the memory of the Civil War, the Lost Cause tradition. And they interviewed us, and then they asked, they must have interviewed six or eight of us, but then they asked two of us to actually sign on to the amicus brief. And we did. One was me, and then the other was Gaines Foster of LSU. And in effect, what they did is that they drew directly from our books. Gaines wrote a book called The Ghost of the Confederacy. I wrote a book called Race and Reunion, which you mentioned, on the memory of the Civil War. And they lifted whole parts from the books, quotations, etc., and made the case against that Lee monument based on modern historical scholarship. That's a fairly remarkable kind of thing for a legal team to do. What they were up against is a lawsuit against the governor, who had issued an executive order, as you probably know, to remove the Lee monument. And there is a law that allowed him to do that. But it was people in the neighborhood of Monument Avenue, as well as apparently a descendant of some family that had contributed money to build that monument. But the people arguing against this, most of them made their case based on what they said was going to be damage to their property values in that neighborhood, which is an ironic argument if you think about it. One might think they could have been more honest and made the neo-Confederate argument, but they didn't. So anyway, this amicus brief, 30-some pages or so, is essentially a historical argument for why that monument represented the Lost Cause tradition, a tradition of white supremacy, a tradition forged in the South in the late 19th century and endured way through the 20th century, that essentially argued that the South didn't fight for slavery. It fought for home and hearth and states' rights tradition. Robert E. Lee, all whatever it was, 60 feet high of him, came down yesterday in Richmond. And I can tell you honestly, none of us historians in this field who have spent our lives studying these subjects, I don't think any of us ever believed we'd see those monuments come down on that street. And it's been the events of recent years that brought that about.
Well, the extraordinary thing is, though, that most of these statues came up, what, in the late 19th century, largely? And if you look at Hollywood, for example, in Los Angeles, where I'm broadcasting from, mm-hmm. Starting with D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, which praised mm-hmm. the Klan, yeah. and then, classic films like Gone with the Wind with Rhett Butler, mm-hmm. and so many films that were made up through the 40s, 50s, into the 60s, mm-hmm. glorified these Confederate soldiers and generals, and all of this idea of civilization and dignity, and instead of casting them as what they were, which is traitors to the United States. How did this happen? How did this mm-hmm. myth develop that these people somehow had sort of Southern values, I guess is the euphemism, mm-hmm. dignity? Mm-hmm. I mean, how can you be dignified if you enslave other human beings?
Well, the Lost Cause tradition was many things. It developed first, early, right after the Civil War, as a response to defeat, to the massive trauma that white Southerners experienced. They did. They lost a war big time. And their property, their lives, their livelihoods were in so many ways destroyed. But in that trauma, they began to develop a story. And the story went something like this. They had never really fought for slavery, they said. They fought only for home, hearth, state sovereignty, independence. And they fought for a cause that was noble and holy. And they said they were one of the world's great examples of a cause that could lose a war but still be right in the end. And by the 1870s, 1880s, and into the 1890s, this, especially in the wake of Reconstruction, became a huge cultural phenomenon. It formed around the Confederate veterans reunions and veterans associations. It formed around the Ladies Memorial Associations. And eventually, by 1890, the organization called the United Daughters of the Confederacy. Robert E. Lee became their sort of mythic saint, the Christian soldier, the man who simply fought for his home, fought for his land, fought for Virginia, didn't really fight for slavery, and so on and so forth, which is not true, by the way. Lee was a fierce Confederate nationalist, a slaveholder. He knew what their cause was. But to your question, how did it take hold? Well, it took hold in a country by the 1880s, 90s, and into the 20th century. They had to find some way to reunify. There had to be some kind of North-South reunion that was attempted during Reconstruction in a host of ways we don't have time to go into. And it was a big success for a short while in establishing new kinds of democracy and rights for the freed people, political rights, civil rights on the ground in the South. But that was crushed in the 1870s by the white counter-revolution in the South. And it was in that success of overthrowing Reconstruction that the Confederate Lost Cause especially got its traction. And by the 1880s and into the 1890s, when these monuments started going up all across the South and well into the early 20th century, the Lost Cause was no longer just a story about loss. It was a story about victory, as they argued it, over Reconstruction. And they portrayed that as a national victory over the racial radicalism of the Reconstruction years. The ultimate consequence of this is that as the Lost Cause came to triumph in the larger American culture, the great loss was in the rights and privileges and livelihoods and opportunities and aspirations of Black people, the very people, 4 million of them, freed in that war. Now, all stories of historical memory are contests over the story, contests over the narrative. And there was always a narrative fighting back against the Lost Cause, for sure, led by all sorts of people, including Frederick Douglass. But in the larger American culture, this reunification, this story of reunion, this idea of blue-gray reunions, this idea of reconciliation of North and South around the mutual valor of soldiers became the great sentimental story. And hence, Confederate monuments fit nicely into that. Even the generic ones, you know, the generic soldiers who just, the smaller monuments who just stand there leaning on their muskets without any name, they became these kinds of sentimental symbols of Southern boys who sacrificed themselves for the nobility of home and hearth right. and section. Right. So it took forever to carve this idea out of our culture, and we still haven't succeeded.
Right. Well, arguably, these young Southern boys, blacksmiths, carpenters, farmers, fought for the plantation owners' right to replace them with slaves. So it's always been very strange for me to try and figure this out. And again, I'm speaking with David Blight, the Sterling Professor of American History and Director of the Gilda Lehrman Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition at Yale University. He's the author of numerous books, articles, and essays on post-Civil War American history, including Race and Reunion, The Civil War in American Memory, and Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom, for which he received the Pulitzer Prize for History, Abraham Lincoln Prize, Bancroft Prize, and the Parkman Prize of the Society of American Historians, among others, recognitions. And his research was used in an amicus brief supporting Virginia Governor Ralph Northam's order to remove the statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee from Richmond's Monument Avenue on Wednesday. So let's talk a little then, if you don't mind, David, about an article that you had a little while back at the New York Review of Books, which was titled Republicans, the New Confederacy. Now, clearly, the vestiges of the Confederacy ended up in the Democratic Party because, after all, Abraham Lincoln was a Republican.
Yeah.
And then in 1965, when Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act, he said, we'll never get another vote in the South as a result of this. So he knew what would happen. And of course, Nixon had the Southern strategy all ready to go. And thus the Republican Party has picked up the Dixiecrats and is now, well, you argue, is the new Confederacy. So expand on that, if you will.
Well, I wrote that piece anticipating last fall's election, the 2020 election. New York Review asked a whole bunch of people to just give their take on why that election was so significant. And what I meant by that is the potential of the current Republican Party, the party of Trump, whether they won or lost. But I guess I was thinking at that point, especially if they won, but now it could still be true, that they really have become, this is the Republicans now, they really have become a political party or movement that essentially doesn't want to live in the same country, the same system, the same institutions with the majority of this country. They are resisting majority rule. They are manipulating and using the undemocratic institutions of the Electoral College and the United States Senate and other measures, especially voter suppression, to try to sustain themselves as a minority persuasion within the larger American polity. Now, I also think there's a strain of Republicans who really just do not believe in government. I mean, just look at them. The only thing many of them believe government exists for is national defense, and then I suppose to protect the things they care about at the state level, whether that's guns or voting or abortion rights, and the list can go on and on and on, or taxation or lowering taxation for corporations and so forth. There is a strain in this modern Republican Party, especially the party that has emerged since Reagan, that is antithetical to the very idea of a participatory democracy. They have been, and they've been very good at this. They've been very successful at gaming the system, at using the American political structures and institutions to sustain their control as they are a minority group. It's the white people's party with a few selected black folk and Hispanic folk along the way who buy into conservatism of some sort for various reasons. But they are a minority movement within our culture that is managing to keep power. Now, I know right at the moment, Democrats have a very narrow control over both houses of Congress and control of the presidency, but that could all change next year in the midterm elections, and I think we all know it. What I meant by the new Confederacy is that there is a kind of a secessionist impulse. They want to either own the country or try to get out of it while staying in it, you know, to retreat, whether it's into gated suburbs or whether it's into private schools or whether it's into any other kind of enclave they can find, because they really do not like the country the United States has become, which is this massive, growing every day, multi-ethnic, multi-racial civilization with people from all corners of the earth, all colors, all religions, all persuasions. I mean, look, Trump's number one issue, if he had a number one issue, was immigration and the border and maintaining an essentially white nationalist nation. As long as that persuasion is dominant in the Republican Party, well, we have the conditions, at least, we have the possibility that Trumpism itself could become a new kind of lost cause.
Well, just now, in the last couple of minutes then, David Blight, the Confederacy was defeated in the Civil War. If we are to have a tyranny of the minority, which the Republicans are working on with voter suppression, and it's comprehensive across the board, and it will be very successful, they'll probably pick up the House in 2022 before one vote is cast via gerrymandering alone. They then get to count and certify the vote, and if they don't like it, they're going to overturn it. They've worked it out. This is happening before our eyes. We see American democracy.
It is happening before our eyes. And people, when they hear Kevin McCarthy, for example, the House Minority Leader, when they hear Kevin McCarthy spew the kinds of things he does and take the positions he does, and even to resist any kind of legitimate investigation of January 6th and so on, a lot of people throw up their hands and say, how can he keep saying this? None of it's true. Well, Kevin McCarthy is not dumb. He believes this will work, just as you're suggesting.
Right.
He believes that through voter suppression, gerrymandering, and the use of the enormous power of right-wing media, that to gain back control of at least the House and possibly the Senate as well. And once they have that, they can blunt anything that Democrats and liberals would wish to do.
Just in closing, though, the Confederacy was defeated in the Civil War. the new Confederacy, the Republican Party of today, this radical party, mm-hmm. has to be defeated. Do you see they any do. Signs that it's going to be defeated? I mean, give me some hope here, David.
Well, they were defeated in 2020. Let's remember that massive mobilization, even in the face of voter suppression, narrowly won some formerly red states, Arizona, Georgia in particular. Now, I grew up in Michigan. Michigan is not a red state. I mean, it has occasionally been a red state in recent decades. But that was also extremely close, as was Pennsylvania. So 2020 is at least a model that a Democratic, let's call it liberal, center, whatever you want, coalition is a majority of the country. But like all other elections, it is all a matter of who can get their people to the polls. I also think, as you may be suggesting here, the Democrats have got to find new tactics, new ways to fight. And that fight has to be, it's for hearts and minds. And it is for the soul of the country. But the fight also has to be structural, because we have some dysfunctional institutions in our society. Start with the Senate. It's a ridiculously undemocratic institution. Go to the Electoral College, and there are many, many other, go to campaign financing. I mean, there's so much that's become undemocratic about our political culture. Unfortunately, those constitutional questions would take a constitutional amendment to change them. And that's almost impossible. In fact, it is impossible in our current politics. So if you can't change the Constitution to get rid of the Electoral College or to change the Senate, then you've got to fight even harder, you know, to try to win elections. And one would like to hope here that Trumpism, Trump himself, and the 2020 election may have educated enough young people, voters in their 20s and their 30s, to realize that elections really matter. Otherwise, you lose the country. I'm not that confident about that, because I've been teaching young people all my life, and by and large, they don't vote until they're scared. So one of the things Democrats have to keep learning how to do is to scare the hell out of the American people, to get them to the polls, to stop this authoritarian movement that is the current Republican Party.
Well, David Blight, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Sure, Ian. I enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with David Blight, the Sterling Professor of American History and Director of the Gilda Lehrman Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition at Yale University. He's the author of numerous books, including Race and Reunion, The Civil War in American Memory, and Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. And his research was used in an amicus brief supporting Virginia Governor Ralph Northam's order to remove the statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee from Richmond's Monument Avenue on Wednesday. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. If you missed any of today's program or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And we also encourage you to rate and review us on those platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. To help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all, please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. Now that I have resigned from Pacifica, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing at backgroundbriefing.org. Bye for now.